You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
David Goss is in my house. I will not let him sit on the furniture.
No.
He's sitting on the floor right now. Yeah. He doesn't get to have a chair anymore.
That's what I'm willing to do.
Hat trick for Deuce. Two hat tricks in four games.
Are you watching the games? Are you just looking at the stats?
Hodgepodge. Yeah, there's a Modge Podge. Whole Modge Podge of rumors.
This is a transfer Modge Podge.
It is an ungodly mess.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about what I want to say.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio on MLSsoccer.com. I, of course, am Andrew Wiebe. He, of course, is David Goss. And this is free soccer content. This is a bonus episode. This is a special.
This is the good stuff.
Uh-huh. This is Brian Dunseth hanging out in the office talking about, oh, man, what doesn't he talk about? No. We got the Olympic team in 2000. We're going to go Miami Fusion.
He's a U.S. soccer lifer. He's almost an MLS lifer. Like, he's almost played the entirety of their career or the entirety of the time of the league. And he's just one of those guys who's been around. He knows everyone from before MLS, U.S. soccer. And you realize that we've talked about this on the show, how small that community is. And it's just cool to hear him talk about what people were like. I mean, you think about some of these people, you know, Ben Olsen's a head coach now.
Yeah.
Brian Dunseth played with him on the U-20 national team. He's got those stories.
Different time of his life.
He knows where the bodies are.
He's got the dirt. Yeah. This is MLS story time with Brian Dunseth. We're happy to bring it to you. Let's give it a listen. Back now on Extra Time Radio, Andrew Wiebe, David Goss, and drumroll please, Brian Dunseth. Dunny, in the house.
What's
we don't
up,
have
man?
A drum, but you're in the blue room. You're hanging out. This is a bonus. If you subscribe on iTunes, if you listen to the podcast, you're bonus material, Dunny. How do you feel about that?
I feel great, man. Listen, being in the headquarters, my first time, I came in yesterday. We did What Did Breck Shea Say on
what
Facebook
the Breck?
Live.
Yeah.
Yeah, What the Breck. I had a blast with you. But, man, these digs. So nice.
Yeah.
So nice. I felt like a princess coming down the stairs and the lights started turning on one section at a time.
It's good to hear that because I think people maybe sometimes think that we're, you know, we talk about being in the broom closet and the aquarium.
We have a nomadic experience.
Yeah. I think people think that we're just kind
as
of like quasi homeless podcasters.
Well, just so you guys know, I mean, I came in 1997, second Project 40 player ever signed to Major League Soccer. Ivan Gazidis, who runs
Arsenal. That's Generation Adidas before
there
was
pre-Generation Adidas. Yeah. Sunil Gulati, Ivan Gazidis, who's at Arsenal. Todd, who else was there?
I mean, Abbott had to be there at that time.
No, Abbott wasn't there. Tim Hankinson. Okay. They all sat in my parents' living room to try to convince them that their son, after three semesters at Cal State Fullerton without declaring a major, should sign for Major League Soccer for a grand total of $27,000 a year, $778.76 per Massachusetts tax laws. And
what was the sell?
Professional soccer, not paying for college.
Right.
Because I wasn't on full scholarship. So they were like, hey, you want to come? And when Sunil Gulati said, hey, we're starting this thing called Project 40, and it was down in Chula Vista with the under-20 national team at the time. We were preparing to go to Malaysia for the under-20 World Cup, and my hand just shot up. And all the guys at Benny Olsen, who's at UVA, and all the UCLA kids, and Matty Chulis, and whatever, all these guys are like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, guys, I'm not on scholarship, so you guys do whatever you got to do. I'm out.
Right.
Like, I'm going. And so my introduction was Thomas Rongen, July 3rd, sitting between Mike Burns and Alexi Lalas. And Thomas Rongen, with an unfiltered red in his mouth, with the spit connecting his bottom lip to his top lip, scared the living bejesus out of me during his very first video session. And was telling Teddy Chronopoulos he should let the ball hit him in the face on a free kick, even though he knows he probably has a second career as a model, that he was a terrible soccer player. And I looked at Alexi and I said, can I go back? Can I rescind this contract and maintain my eligibility?
What were those days like? We love these, like, because people sometimes forget. They see the now shiny version of MLS with the beautiful stadiums, or opening one in Orlando, and there's expansion teams, and Atlanta has 55,000 people, and Joseph Martinez is an international at 23 who's scoring goals in the league. There was a time when it wasn't quite so shiny.
I mean, you go back even to 2003, 2004, and you remember Dragon Stadium, the high school football stadium in Dallas before, the stadium was finished. It's funny you bring this up because Dante Washington and I talk about this quite a bit.
People are going to be on Wikipedia through this episode.
Going back. El Tanque Hurtado and Woldy Harris, and I'll drop names. No, I mean, we go back, and Greg Lawless and I were just talking about it a second ago, playing for the New England Revolution, training at Brandeis University, fire alarms going off in the bathroom because Walter Zenga and Beppe Galderisi are having a smoke after practice in the shower. You know, it was playing professional soccer and just being alive and being in the moment and having an outlet and being so thankful that in 1995 and 96, I played college because guys that were 2 years older than me had no place to go after their eligibility ran out. You know, maybe a couple guys ended up in Denmark. Maybe a guy ended up in German third division. Maybe a guy was lucky to go to Mexico. But to be there and watch the LA Galaxy against the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars at the Rose Bowl in 1996 and know that there was a path, there was a trajectory, there was something that you could actually be after college was phenomenal. So for me, a kid with less talent than anyone else, watching guys with more talent in their pinky toe, you know, being able to step on the field. I remember being on the under-20s and being with Josh Wolf and Benny Olsen and playing and scrimmaging the LA Galaxy and kicking Kobe Jones for the first time. And
You always know. Remember the first time you kicked
Kobe.
Oh,
and Benny crushing Kobe with a comment and all of us giggling and laughing. Man, we were such jerks, entitled jerks. But, yeah, listen, it was everything. It still is everything. And I have a hard time, and maybe it's just me having the institutional knowledge of how hard it was back in the day and how close we were to not surviving on so many different occasions. And then to see $100 million expansion clubs coming in, it has surpassed my wildest dreams. And I'm still so thankful to be a part of it and to see not only MLS but USL and the lower leagues and the opportunities for guys. Guys can make careers out of it. And that just wasn't the case 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago.
That U20 team, though, early on. Were other guys talking about MLS? Like, what was the idea for players at that level where they knew they could probably play pro of, like, what they wanted their careers to be?
No. At that level, I mean, this was the barometer. If you were at UCLA, if you were at Clemson, if you were at University of Virginia, you did not walk away from that college scholarship. Because those guys, it was, you know, it was about getting your college education and what would you do next? Because you had that. You had that incredible piece of paper that said you could basically walk through the door of any company and get a job right away. So, no, it wasn't about playing soccer. Maybe, you know, maybe there's a chance. But then Carlos Parra broke the mold. And thankfully, Carlos failed an English class in high school, which led to his being ineligible at the University of Maryland. And he had just been capped because there was a strike with the U.S. men's national team over their player agreement. So Steve Sampson took a bunch of unknowns to Chile and got a decent result. Carlos Parra was one of the guys, and all of a sudden it was like, well, hey, U.S. Soccer, Nike, MLS, partnership, can we do this? Can we provide maybe scholarship-ish material for kids to go back to school? Maybe that can be the incentive to get guys to come just be a little bit younger. And again, it was an easy decision for a couple of us, and a couple guys took a little bit longer, the Chris Albrights and the Benny Olsons and the Brian Wests. But again, it all came down to which guys were at which massive college and the weight of that graduation on the shoulders of parents saying, you're not leaving for that money. Mm-mm. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, Benny's on like $100,000. And I remember looking at him like, why didn't you get the $27,000?
You were messed up. You were the guy that really should have been taking him in the face. Oh, huh? Man. The free kicks, like, Dunny, get in there, man. Move him out of the way.
I still will never change being able to. I will never trade the ability to play for TR, Thomas Rongen. I mean, if you could never look in the mirror and hold yourself accountable, you learned how to do that within the first 2 weeks of playing under Thomas because he would hold you accountable. He was hilarious, and you knew that unfiltered red Dutch mentality was coming at you really, really fast.
You're talking about some of these names and the Josh Wolfs of the world, and I'm thinking back to 2000 Olympics. Hmm. I looked at that roster this morning.
Crazy,
it is
right?
Unreal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. You got the Tim Howards of the world, DeMarcus Beasley's, Landon Donovan's, Brad Friedel, Agus is here, Frankie Hayduk, Danny Califf, Olsen, Vahanas, Albright, Corrales, Victorine. I mean, the
Connor Casey,
the legendary Brian Dunseth. It goes on and on and on. I mean, what were the training sessions for this? Like, what was the – you're going to Sydney. You're trying to win a gold medal.
Yeah.
We've had some issues qualifying recently for this tournament. What was the mindset going into that? And what was it like to be with these guys day in, day out?
You know, for as incredible as that team was, it wasn't about the players. It was about Clive Charles. And when he passed away, I think U.S. soccer, college kids, NCAA, you lost the one in a million. Because for as much as – and listen, everybody tells Clive Charles stories, and everybody's talking about a father figure, a best friend, all that, and that's exactly what he was. And
just so you know, NSL legend, University of Portland guy. I mean,
started London kids, started West Ham, one of the first black players to play for West Ham, played for the Portland Timbers. Yeah, ended up staying when the Timbers contracted through one of the collapses of the early days of the leagues.
Go wiki that for sure.
Yeah,
go look
University of Portland men and women, Stevie Cherundolo, Christy Sinclair, Shannon McMillan. I mean, he's Heath Pierce, Connor Casey. I mean, the names go on
Luis
and on.
Luis Robles.
Yeah. Luis Robles, another
one. On
Darren Sawatsky. I'll go
yeah,
super deep.
I mean, these are the sort of history lessons that I think, you know, and I think we have some incredibly smart listeners who know the history of soccer in this league, but Clive, you have to go look this up.
Yeah, Clive Charles, 100%.
Anyway, so you guys are, you know, in training. This is for Clive.
I mean, so we got done with the Under-20 World Cup in Malaysia, and Clive was there. And I just remember knowing who he was. And then next thing you know, after the tournament's over, he's calling us together. And we're going down to, at the time, Clive was still the assistant coach with Steve Sampson. So we're in Orlando at Disney World Complex. And we had like a dual camp. And after that camp, a bunch of us got to kind of stick around and train with the first team for the full national team. And it was kind of set in motion. Like, here's the pathway. The success at the under-23s, which we were all 20, 21 at that time still. We knew in 2000 the Olympics were on the horizon, so we basically had 2.5 years together where every month we would even get together just for a one-off game just to keep the stylistic idea together. And so I know the 4-4-2 with the diamond is a Jason Christ thing in MLS, but the 4-4-2 and the diamond was what we had played from the beginning of 1998 through the Olympics. And you could play anybody against – you could play a 3-5-2, 4-4-2, 4-2-3-1, whatever, and you could adjust because we just knew how to play it. It was our system. It was to the point where it was so ingrained in our minds how to play any opponent in the system that Clive wouldn't even have to say anything. You know, we could just instantly recognize and adjust immediately. But we traveled the world. I mean, we went to Germany and we went to England and we beat Liverpool at Liverpool. We beat Manchester United at the Cliff. And they were obviously reserves with like sprinkled in and Danny Murphy's and those types. And, you know, the Phil Neville's and the West Browns of the day. But, you know, we traveled the world. We went to France. We went to Germany, went to Spain. We beat Sevilla at Sevilla. It was just an incredible time. And then to go to the Olympics and have the additions. You know, to lose Aiden Brown to a knee issue, but to bring in a Brad Friedel, you know, to have Chris Armas be our defensive midfielder heading in the tournament and him tear his knee. Pete Vahena slides in alongside Johnny O'Brien and we bring Jeff Agus to add Frankie Hayduk to the mix and the dude on the right hand side. And then to be in a group where you're playing Cameroon, you're playing Qatar, you're playing Czech Republic, then you knock out Japan in penalties, then you lose to Spain. But, you know, in the bronze medal match, I hit the crossbar in the post and go down the other way and they get a penalty. And just to know, like, how close you were. Mm-hmm.
By the way, that Cameroon team, Samuel Eto'o is the star of that team. They won the tournament.
Yep.
That was a team.
Yeah.
You guys finished
above
them in the
Spain.
Group.
They beat Xavi Puyol in the final. I mean, Italy had Rino Gattuso, and it was incredible.
Are you guys? I mean, we always hear about the village. Do the soccer players hang out? Do you have any? You know, are you like drinking Kool-Aid next to Xavi?
So it was a little bit different. Okay, so because the soccer is a multi-city in the tournament. So we went to Canberra, which is kind of like the DC. Ish, about a 2-hour drive. And by the way, roadkill are, animals you're not used to seeing as roadkill. You're seeing kangaroos on the side of the road that have been wild kangaroos have been hit by buses and trucks. A little bit different. So we went Canberra, then we went to Melbourne, then we went to Adelaide, and then we went back to Sydney. And that's when we were in the knockout rounds. We played against Spain and Chile. And so they didn't have hotels because all the big teams, the Brazils and the Italys, had booked all the hotels saying, well, we're going to be in the knockout round, so we're already good. So we had to go. We were the surprise of the tournament at that point. So we had to go to the compound. We had to go to the center. And I'd heard stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're an Olympian, you end up hearing these stories like, dude, the
you
village.
Said that so cow.
Yeah, right?
You know, when you're an Olympian. Well,
so you start hearing these stories.
You're a Greek god.
I apologize. When you're in, let me take it back. When you're in San Diego and you're prepping, you go for like this little pre-thing where you get all sized out, you get all your stuff, and everybody starts talking about the village. And you hear all these stories like, dude, wait till you get the box. And you're like, what are you talking about, the box? Like, there's surprises in the box. And we're like, okay, what's the surprises? They're like extracurricular surprises. And you're like, everyone's like, what the hell are they talking about? So we're not in the village. And we can't go to opening ceremonies because our game is the next night. And so we kind of missed out on some of the environment of what the Olympics was about. So then we get in there, and Clive's like, we're here for 2 nights. Don't be stupid. I know what's going to happen. Just keep your head straight.
Right.
Like, what's he talking about? So when you check in, they give you boxes. And in the stuff that they give you are like condoms. And like, I'll just say, condoms were in the box. And all, like, then you start talking to people, and it was basically like a clock, right? So say 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock would be the athletes that competed first. And as your event was scheduled, it would be like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4. And so there was this little common theme that once your event was over, you would drape your flag out of the window. And that would let everybody know that you were done. So as this party got louder and, you know, the commissary is in the middle.
Right.
But it starts as like.
You start seeing more flags.
Yeah.
Start to pop
and
out.
Like,
yeah.
For the right, it's going, it's wrapping around. It's getting louder and louder and louder and louder. And the parties, there's like a little dance club. But you think about from an athlete's perspective, you're so focused for 4 years that when your event is over, win, lose, or draw, you are going to have a very good time, and you are going to go ham. And that's exactly what happened. So we didn't really get to experience that environment for too long because we were immediately moved into a really cool hotel in Sydney.
But it made some impressions. I can hear that, yeah.
For us that were on teams that weren't so good, and namely being the New England Revolution, the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars at the time, Timmy Howard and Ramiro Corrales and myself, we all stayed after the Olympics to take in the environment. And we had a good time. We stayed for, I think, 7-10 days, traded out a couple jerseys, got free hotel rooms, free lunch and dinner, because at that point everyone was taken off. We still got the experience. It was a little bit later, but man, oh man.
You didn't stick with New England, though. Miami Fusion days.
I got traded a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one I asked. I went into Fernando Clavijo's office every day for about 30 straight days asking for a trade. And
what's that conversation like? Hey, Fernando, trade me.
Yeah, and Fernando's like, Brian, the thing that it is, nobody wants you. It was very clear cut. I was like, can you make this a little bit softer? No, Brian, nobody wants you.
Oh, man.
And then all of a sudden, I got the call. I was driving downtown Boston. Like, I got a call from Ray Hudson. Rocky calls me. He's like, Briny, I'm so excited to have you. You're going to be the Statue of Liberty back there. And he's going off, and he's doing what he does on BN, but he's dropping F-bombs. And I was like, I finally got down there and started training. I got traded for Jay Heaps. So it was me and a bent bicycle pump for Jay Heaps. They got the better of the deal, surprisingly.
That's the best bicycle pump they've ever had.
It was a good one. Future manager of the club. And I finally got down to Ray, and I was like, man, thank you so much. Like, I really, like, I love my time at New England, but obviously Fernando and I weren't getting along. And he's like, Briny, I've been trying to get you since last fall. And I was like, wait, what? He's like, yeah, I've been trying to get you since fall last year. And I was like, damn it, Fernando. Damn you, Fernando.
Hey, man, he's got to play the game.
The thing that it is, nobody wants you. And I was like, man. Yeah, good times.
That was a good team, though.
So
hell of a team.
Yeah.
We've heard stories about the environment, Olympic style that you had down there. Did Ray Hudson look for people that could party and play, or was the second one a coincidence after the play?
It was all coincidence that guys like to party on that team.
And they just end up in Miami.
They just end up in Miami. Man, that team, that group of players. Listen, I know like the 98 DC United and the 99 LA Galaxy, and you can go through kind of phases of teams that really stood out. That 01 Miami Fusion team was, in my opinion, the best team in the history of Major League Soccer. Diego Serna, Chicky Chacon up top. We had Preki underneath.
Mm-hmm.
You had Chris Henderson on the left. You had Jimmy Rooney and Ian Bishop playing centrally. Defenders, you had a choice of Ivan McKinley, Carlos Llamosa, Pablo Mastroeni, Tyrone Marshall, myself, Jeff Cassar, Nicky Raimondo were goalkeepers. Kyle Beckerman was on the team. Johnny Torres was on the team. Greg Simmons was on the team. I think I pretty much just named the entire roster.
Yeah, I'm looking
roster.
At the roster here, and I'm like, yeah, that's the whole team. 16-5-5, I think.
Yeah.
But then that's the last year. I mean, was
that was also September 11th when everything went really sideways. And we were actually meeting in the locker room, and our road trip was that Tuesday. We were flying to New York to play the New York Red Bulls, and then staying in New York, and then going to DC to play DC United. And at the time, the hotel at D.C. was across the street from the Pentagon where the MLS team hotel was. So we were all getting together to take the bus to the airport. And that's when the second plane hit the towers and everything immediately got shut down. And so it was obviously horrific, horrific couple of weeks in terms of confusion. Nobody knew what was really going on. But through all of that, you know, playoffs continued, and we felt like we were on the end of some really bad calls, and the team no longer existed, and we all went our separate ways. By the way, Doug Hamilton was the general manager, and he ended up going to LA and having a ton of success before he passed away on our flight back from Costa Rica against Saprissa. Another salt of the earth guy. But yeah, that team was, we could never beat Tim Howard and Mike Pecky and the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars for some reason, but we demolished everybody else.
Right.
But when you came to New York, you guys enjoyed. You were telling me a little bit before.
So, I mean, listen. Ray was one of those guys that really focused on the team bonding aspect.
That's how you
know. That's political. I like that.
If you know Ian Bishop and you know Ivan McKinley, usually the team bonding was, and it usually involved playing quarters. There was beer involved. And it was a different time, right? Like now you see the guys and they take their shirt off and like, why are they wearing sports bras? Well, they got the tracking device between their shoulder blades. Back then it was like you warmed up and if you were not sober, you were sober because the heat and humidity, and it was skins and bibs. Like that was just how we played. And the training sessions were incredibly intense, but when they were over, it was family. Like you hung out. So I mean, there were bus trips with drinking games and playing moose. It was you get done with a game, and if you were injured, you could stay at the hotel. If you're not, it was highly recommended that as a team you didn't come back before 1 o'clock. It was obviously a cultural thing, but it was an incredible bonding experience. And I think that was one of the few teams that I've been on where everybody got along and everybody wanted to hang out and everybody wanted to get dinner. And it's not like that anymore. Obviously everything's changed, the accountability, the amount of games, the season, all that. But it was a phenomenal time in my life. My bank account hated me. Didn't really have much money left. But, man, we tore up Las Olas and Fort Lauderdale. Lottie-dottie hadn't seen anything like
they
that.
They like to party there, no doubt about that. Man. Did it feel like I don't know what the right word for this is. Did you guys know that this was it? that this was going to be the last year? When did you know, and how did that affect the season? Or was it a surprise
at
the end?
There weren't any real whispers. I mean, you remember, back then it was like MLSnet.com, and like it was there wasn't a lot of information out there. That was like the main soccer source. And then you started hearing whispers about Miami and Tampa and Dallas and Kansas City being, you know, the four that were in the mix of could they possibly go away. And I think, you know, as I look back, I think a lot of us knew, just because our owner at the time, it felt like a champagne life on a beer budget. You know, it felt like things were getting tight. And, you know, when you compared and contrast talking to other guys in the league, what was had and what wasn't there was significantly different at times. But man, when you walk up, and at the time, this was like before direct deposit. This was, you know, like you went and physically got your paycheck on a certain day. I remember pulling up and Ray was outside, Doug Hamilton was outside, and it was like, well, this will be your last paycheck. And for those who don't, you don't get paid by the club, you get paid by Major League Soccer. Mm-hmm. That's one of the big selling points that if you sign a contract, you're going to get paid that money. It's not like that in other countries. But you would get your check from your club. And I just remember the guy saying, this is the last time you'll get your paycheck from here. And that confusion and disappointment and knowing that something was so pure in terms of what was on the field and in the locker room was never going to be there again. It was tough. It sucked. But 'tis the life of of an athlete.
Speaking of locker room, we have something on Twitter from Red Medicine PDX. He wants to know, worst locker room bust up you've seen or been a part of.
I've been a part of one.
You can change names if you want.
Yeah. No, I've been a part of one. There's one team. Well, one significant one. It's hard for fans to, I think, understand that inside of a locker room, you don't have to like each other. There's some really good guys, but there's some guys that you would not want to spend any time whatsoever around. You know, you equate that to a business setting or a work setting. Like, there's plenty of guys in this office that you two in particular wouldn't want to hang out with outside of this
sitting
office.
Right next
to you. I mean, unfortunately, somehow we got stuck in the same.
It was an awkward look between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But there, it's a different mentality. On the field, there's accountability and there's aggression and there's an understanding that careers only have so much time. And if you're not pulling your weight, like, I'm going to make sure you're pulling your weight. And then there's, from a coach's standpoint, the accountability, who gets away with stuff, who doesn't get away with stuff. I've seen U.S. internationals drop other U.S. internationals in the middle of a training session. I've seen tackles where guys are coming in the back of people's knees. I've seen guys go after others because they were in their position and they wanted to play and taking them out. I had one punch up that was off the field in a private residence, and it was stupid and immature, but I also let this person know that if that was the language he was going to use with me, I wasn't going to stand for it. And there was a swing and a counter swing and a broken nose and some black eyes and some blood everywhere. And, you know, you look back and
stakes are high.
Stakes are high.
Emotions are high.
Yeah.
We kind of saw that a little bit with Alejandro Bedoya and Jose Altidore.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
What did you think of that? Yeah, I mean, that was it's great for us to talk about.
Yeah.
It also shows people some of that back end that it's not all, you know, friends and hugs.
Not
and
all brothers.
Puppy dogs.
Yeah, not all brothers.
Yeah, and people are competitive, and they
100%.
They'll react.
Well, and so I'll give you my background, how I came across this. I saw Josie's tweet, and I was like, wow, there's some fire right there. And then I saw the reference to it and the response, and I understood immediately. And this is the problem with social media, right? You read what you read, and you can take it out of context, or you can put it into whatever context you want. So I saw Josie's response to the quotes, and I was like, wow, that's number one. Good for Josie for responding that way. Like, he's not afraid. Number two, I was surprised that Ali said what he said. Then I saw the video of how Alejandro said it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was tongue-in-cheek. I could see how he was saying it. It was more like jokey, maybe.
But there was a combination of
truth
frustration
and sarcasm.
There, right?
Yeah, like maybe he did go down. But I love it. I mean, we were talking about this. Mm-hmm. there's such a need for more villains. There's such a need for bigger conversation. And this is the second time we've seen this. We saw it with Timmy Howard's comments, and then Jermaine Jones coming back. And I'm okay with it. I want personality. I think it's fine. And guess what? They'll be just fine. Josie and Alejandro will go in practice. They'll give high fives. They'll hug. They'll get on the field. Everybody's going in the same direction. Bruce won't allow for any type of disconnect. Bruce is a player's coach. He gets it. It'll sort itself out, and it'll be just fine. But I liked it.
You're talking about the national team, and you were talking about the Olympic team and how much you guys were focused on it and involved for 2.5 years. We hear comments from people from other countries that are a little confused, or they think it's different the way Americans view their national team compared to other countries. Your experience with international players compared to Americans, is it a different view?
No. No. I think the perception's only different from the fans. We're still growing. There's still not, in a lot of ways, big picture. There's a very loud minority, especially on Twitter, that is super passionate, super hypersensitive, and that us versus them mentality. And I love it because they're making it theirs. But there's a broader issue, I think, where the ideology of this is my club, this is my loyalty, this is who I believe in, is still it's a work in progress. As more teams come in, you could have been a Chivas USA fan and not wanted to be a Galaxy fan, and now you're going to be an LAFC fan. So that those lines and those brands, I think, at times are massively disconnected, and at times are really, really intersected. But in terms of the national team, from a player's perspective, there is no bigger honor than being a part of a national team camp. And it doesn't matter if it's a friendly against New Zealand and Cuba, or it's a World Cup qualifier against Honduras and Panama, or going to a World Cup. The moment that you get that call, it gives you chills. You know that you have been identified as one of the elite in the United States. Well, one of the elite with a U.S. passport, regardless of where you play. And there's something bigger than you. And I promise you, when you put that jersey on, and I put it on in the 23s, and maybe 10 U.S. games that I was a part of a roster underneath Bruce and Steve Sampson, there's nothing better, man. And you wish that you can just press pause, and that's your world, and you could just stay there forever, because it represents more than you. And I think that's the understanding. And whether you're a pro-Klinsmann fan or an anti-Klinsmann, whether you're pro-Bruce or you hate Bruce, the reality is when you're on that field, there's something bigger. There's something more powerful. And not for a second do any of those players, I hope, that I've ever been around, I hope not for a second do any of them take it for granted, not understand the gravity of what they're representing.
There's gravity in the situation right now, no doubt about that. Mm. You mentioned Honduras and Panama. These are big games coming up on Friday to start in San Jose against Los Catrachos. Mm. Are you worried at all?
Yeah.
Because they need the, like, qualification for the World Cup. We take it for granted.
Yeah.
It's not guaranteed, and it could be a significant blow to soccer in this country if it doesn't happen.
And again, whether you're pro or anti-Clancy, are you pro or anti-Bruce Arena, the reality is that CONCACAF has gotten significantly better, and MLS has played a major part in that. And the success of Mexico and the United States in the World Cup over the years has drawn more interest for individual players, individual opportunities, and shift of focus of, are we Mexican-based? Are we European-based? Are we MLS-based? Are we European-based? You look at Kyoto, you look at Elise, you look at Boni, you look at any of those guys, and game changers. And it used to be, I was talking with Eddie Pope not too long about this. It used to be you had one or two guys that were like, okay, we got to be aware of these guys. Now you look at the entire team, and I was actually just doing all the prep work for the two games. I mean, Honduras and Panama, the amount of guys that have played over 80 times for their country is frightening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like 5-6 guys on the field, and then mixed in with, you know, 4 or 5 kids that are Olympic age that are phenomenal. So it's not ideal with Bobby Wood out and Fabian Johnson out. Obviously, you know, you think Brad Guzan's miss isn't going to be that massive only because Timmy's back.
But then you think that Mexico game and you think about him pulling up and you're like, oh, yeah. I mean, things can happen.
Things can happen, yeah. And you know, we made a big deal about this, what, 4 or 5 days ago that, wait a second, where's Sasha Kljestan? Wait a second, mm-hmm. where's Benny Fellhaber? Wait a second, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, Beasley's added, Zusi's added, Sasha's added. So it's not going to be nearly – I don't think enough people are giving credit to both Honduras and Panama because it's not like it used to be. It used to be three games you worried about. You worried about Mexico, home and away, and you worried about Costa Rica at Estadio Ricardo Saprissa on the turf. Every name, Honduras is better. Panama's better.
San Pedro Sula is a place of nightmares right now.
And there's a Panama team that should have qualified.
Panama beat them. But, yeah, I agree. It's frightening. And, again, it goes back to, we talked about the inability of the United States to qualify for the Olympics, I think, has lost a generation of battle-tested kids that recognize in the moment how to get themselves out of trouble and understand what it's like to chase a game and understand what it's like to protect the lead in a hostile environment.
One of the other things we got on Twitter, something that came out from U.S. Soccer, is U-17 residency. It's going to be the last class.
Yep.
You have a smile on your face because you want to talk about it.
I think it's good. I think it speaks to the evolution, the importance. You know, we're always talking about in MLS, DPs, target allocation money, big name players, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think we're doing enough of a service to, of talking about the amount of money that's being sunk into the development academies. Because it's not just the future, but it was the necessity of having an ideological approach to how to streamline to the first team from under eights all the way through. And I think it negates everything that the under-17s were. The under-17s were, hey, there's really talented club soccer players, and they're probably going to go to college, and hey, let's get them together, and let's see if we can develop them. And hey, here's 1,800 pairs of cleats, and they're all $200 each, and you guys are the best of the best. Hey, we love you. Everything's great. Yeah. And you found some really good players. But then you coddled some players that when they got to the pros, they were unable to understand the situation and that, no, you're not a kid anymore. And no, we're not going to take care of you. And no, you don't get to start just because you went to Bradenton.
Yep.
So I think it's a great thing. I think it speaks to the growth. And it speaks to the importance, not only the academy, but the USL sides attached to MLS. And now there's an incredible opportunity to get higher level games with more consistency and still being in the environment of your club and the structure of the club.
MLS is imperfect. We know that, but we love it. That's why we're here. Yep. If you're listening to it, congratulations. That means you're either subscribing on iTunes or coming to the site. We like that. We want to interact with you. We have one more question, Danny, before we get you out of here.
Give it to me.
You talked about TAM. You talked about the league. We sat around. We watched games. We talked about games yesterday. You look at MLS right now. What excites you the most on the field product? What players have you getting excited? I mean, when you're what makes this special right now?
I am on record consistently saying that this next 3 years are going to be the fast forward button for Major League Soccer. I think when we look back 10 years from now and we say, wow, I can't believe we got here. I think we're going to look back and this will be the monumental phase of this league where we really take off. I think the way it's been built on the backside, this league, even here at headquarters, to what the product and the consumer is able to have at the touch of their fingers, and then the ability from the players to streamline and be identified at such a young age and have the structure to take the steps. We always talk about the academies and the systems. Do we want to be Ajax? Do we want to be Barcelona? Mm-hmm. What do we want to be? Well, now we have the ability to actually execute. So I think these 3 years, I just continue to say it, this is going to be the 3 years. I love seeing what I saw from Atlanta. I love seeing owners not sit back on their tax write-offs and say, holy moly, I have to compete. I have to spend money. And what Arthur Blank has done in conjunction with the Falcons, with the stadium build, with what they've built in their training facility, identifying Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra and Paul McDonough, Tata Martino, and then what's on the field. I mean, Assad, Viaba, Almiron, Josef Martinez, mixed in with a Tyrone Mears and a Greg Garza and a Michael Parkhurst and a Larenowitz and a young kid like Julian Gressel. It's phenomenal. And it shows you distinctly how you can build an expansion team in comparison to Minnesota United. And so you look at what's happening in Seattle and what's happening in Portland and what's happening in Sporting Kansas City and all of these teams that have this kind of fan culture. Now we're seeing it with Atlanta, and it makes me incredibly excited for LAFC next season. The other thing is, I know I kind of joke around and call it "you suck" allocation money, missing the playoffs,
right,
and getting a little bit of bump.
Right.
And it's not massive, but you see that in conjunction with TAM and the salary cap raising, the homegrown status, being able to raise that even higher, and seeing teams, even the Portland Timbers, missing out on the playoffs and being able to go get Guzman and kind of reshuffle the back
Blanco,
line.
Yeah.
Blanco's been phenomenal as well. Making mistakes and being able to rectify those mistakes. The Houston Dynamo with Cabrera and Kyoto and Elise and Kubo and Cabezas and Machado, AJ De La Garza. It's not just about the coaches. It's not just about the first team. Now you have technical directors, general managers, scouting networks, all of this. So this is why I keep kind of circling back to this next 3 years, because I think the ownership group gets it. I think MLS gets it. I think the clubs get it. And it, with the introduction of all of these new owners, Don Garber's not sitting around a table with four guys trying to convince them to do things. He actually has a table of 20-something guys saying, no, this is what we need to do. Mm-hmm. You want to take giant steps forward. We want to be more aggressive on this side or that side. So that's what I'm excited for. And it's the parity. Everyone talks about, you know, you can go in whatever direction you want. But with this league, if you would have said that San Jose, Portland, Houston, immediately right, Atlanta United right out the gates would be the best teams in Major League Soccer. And I know I'm going to get hammered because they're going to say, what about my team? What about this team? If you just see how quickly they've gotten off on the right foot, it's not easy. The West is a bloodbath. The Eastern Conference has gotten significantly better. It's makes for some great results, some great games.
3 years, watch him, Dunny says. Also watch Brian Dunstan because he's everywhere. He's
you
a
give
walking,
me a job, yeah. I'll take it.
Hey, you're a walking red eye, dude. You may have a job. We'll see what happens on MLS Match Day Live.
So.
Thank you for listening. This is a bonus for you. We hope you enjoyed it. I wish we could have talked to him longer, but as always, Dunny had a flight to catch. We hope you enjoyed that.
He's
got to
get back to the fresh air of Salt Lake City, the bike rides, the skiing easily while we're crammed into our subway cars.
It's a great life here. Go in the green room, go in the blue room, you know, have somebody yell at you through the subway line on the G train.
Or listen to Simon yell instant replay in the room next to you.
Hey, I'm actually down with that. That should be a good episode as well. Make sure you catch that. Make sure you catch all the action this weekend. Three MLS games with a plenty of hex to consume. With that, we're going to get out of here. Catch us again on Thursday.
You're listening to Extra Time Radio.